Mary A. here, do you hear me? The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session, pursuant to adjournment.
Good morning, you may be seated. The first case in our calendar is 0016, Nancy O. Crowe versus Continental General Tire, Inc. Ms. Smith.
Thank you. Can you please record every one of your 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal? My name is Catherine Smith. I represent the account in this case of Nancy Crowe, who on September 28, 1998, obtained unanimous jury verdict in her favor on her claim for sex discrimination against the Appalachian Continental General Tire Incorporated. On December 15, 1999, the Ninth District Court of Appeals reversed the trial court's denial of General Tire's motion for directed verdict and entered judgment for General Tire. We believe this decision is in error for three reasons. First, the Ninth District Court of Appeals applied such a restrictive interpretation to the term comparable so as to preclude the protections of Revised Code 4112 to most, if not all, plaintiffs in discrimination cases.
Can I stop?
Certainly.
The Court of Appeals opinion, it talks about comparable and similar, and does that test go to the issue of Ms. Crowe not receiving the appointment to the position of assistant clerk treasurer and others essentially taking her duties, as you allege? Doesn't that go just to the pay inequity?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. And that really leads into the second issue that we have with the District Court of Appeals decision, and that is that we believe that they determined issues of credibility and weighed the evidence in this case, and finally their decision was based upon issues that were weighed by General Tire at the trial court level. In this decision, the Court of Appeals determined that Nancy Crowe was not comparable to any of the six male managers in the Treasury Department and General Tire. These six male employees included Mike Worthington and Kevin Bankston, who assumed 100% of their job duties, and they included four male managers who held the title of manager as did Nancy Crowe. These gentlemen were Mike Brobeck, Ray Doyle, Lab Letter, and Bill Smith.
Matt, we've read the briefs and have all the facts, and we know about the disparate treatment that you're alleging and all. I'd like to go directly to the law that we involved. As I understand it, what you'd like is reinstatement of the jury verdict. However, you want it sent back for the attorney's fees issue, prejudgment interest, and punitive damages.
Correct.
Could you explain to me how punitive damages are in the case?
Well,
how would you get to punitive damages?
What fact?
I mean, you'd have to show malice or real reckless disregard for the rights of...
Well, I believe in most cases of intentional discrimination, there is sufficient evidence to present the issue of actual malice as defined under Ohio law to the jury and to let the jury decide. Actual malice it lends itself as defined in Ohio law to cases of intentional discrimination where there is conscious disregard of an employee's rights with great probability of causing substantial harm.
So you're almost saying it's a per se test. If, in fact, you find intentional discrimination, ergo, it follows the punitive damages are appropriate.
I think usually yes, particularly when there is that burden.
Usually yes.
Yes.
Maybe not always?
Maybe not always.
Okay.
Maybe there is a case where under the facts of that particular case, it cannot be shown that there's a genuine issue of fact that's with conscious disregard.
Let's assume that what I see here, what we see here, I think is bad. Would you believe that we've seen worse?
Do I believe? I'm sorry.
Would you believe that we have seen worse?
Sure.
Okay. So this is not really on the level of the most intentional discrimination, but neither is it the least.
I wouldn't go that far. I mean, I guess I would phrase it that way. I would say that that issue would be for the jury to decide. It goes to the amount of punitive damages to be awarded, but where there is in fact evidence of the record, if there is in this case a pattern in practice of discrimination continuing from 87 to 96, where Ms. Crow repeatedly complained, nothing was done, where the general tire had an opportunity when one of the males turned down the position to laterally transfer Ms. Crow, refused to do so, and instead promoted a male from several tiers below her in the organizational.
I know the facts. All I want to do is, apparently you're saying that in every case of intentional discrimination, it is a jury question as to whether or not punitive damages should be assessed.
I'm saying it would be, yes. And there may be an exception to that rule, but that in most cases where the plaintiff has presented sufficient evidence of intentional discrimination, that then yes, there's evidence of actual malice defined under Ohio law. And where in Ohio we award punitive damages also to make an example of the defendant, then it's appropriate for punitive damages to go to the jury.
Do you argue that on that point, do you argue that our test that we stated a number of years ago in Preston v. Murty that for determining punitive damages should not apply here, or is there some other test that applies to discrimination cases in your view?
No, I believe that it's defined under Ohio law and Preston that in fact that
hatred, ill will, revenge, spirit of revenge, is that what are the facts here, assuming that you're correct on the other issues, that there should be a judgment for your client as the jury awarded. What are the facts that would suggest hatred or revenge, maybe ill will, but what are the most relevant facts?
Well, in this particular case, under the facts of this case, and in many cases of discrimination, I believe that it falls under the conscious disregard of an employee's rights with great probability of causing substantial harm. I don't know that, I think that prong of the punitive damages test applies in most cases of intentional discrimination, and certainly in this case. With respect to the Court of Appeals decision as to taking this finding of fact that Nancy Crow was not comparable to these male managers, and then plugging in that therefore she could not prevail on her claim for discriminatory termination, we would assert to this court that there's no basis in the law or fact for such a finding, that the burdens of proof are distinct, that as Chief Justice Moyer said at the beginning of my argument, that there's no the issue of comparability does not apply to discriminatory termination, and therefore we believe also that the Court of Appeals erred by doing so in the December 15, 1999 decision. Finally, we believe that General Taylor waived any right to assert on appeal the issue of comparability based upon the jury's instructions that it provided to the court, based upon its non-objection as to the interrogatory submitted to the jury. General Tire never requested that this claim be broken down. This fair pay was discriminatory termination, and therefore we believe that we would respectfully request that this court reverse the decision of the Ninth District Court of Appeals and reinstate the jury's verdict in this case.
What's your best argument that 41-1202 and 41-1299 allow for the assessment of costs and attorney's fees?
It's well established that attorney's fees and costs are awarded under federal anti-discrimination statutes, but part of that make-whole remedy. And I believe that under Ohio's anti-discrimination statutes, claims should be awarded that same remedy.
Are you familiar with our case Rice versus Certainty?
Yes.
Why aren't you referring us to that case that permits punitive damages? Our case in 99.
Okay, that case is cited in
okay.
My brief. And, as we discussed this morning in my brief, I do believe punitive damages should be awarded. Obviously, under Rice, punitive attorney fees and costs are awarded as part of punitive damages. In this case, punitive damages did not go to the jury. However, I believe, as under federal anti-discrimination statute, that we are looking under revised Code 41-12, provide a make-whole remedy to plaintiffs in discrimination cases, then certainly attorney's fees and costs are part of that make-whole remedy. Finally, with respect to the issue of prejudgment interest, I think there was sufficient evidence in the record for prejudgment interest to be sent to the jury in this case. And I would respectfully request...
To be sent to the jury?
I'm sorry. For prejudgment...
For the court to issue...
For the court to award prejudgment interest in this case, and I would respectfully request that this court remand in order to do so. I believe my time is up, and I would look forward to addressing you in rebuttal if there are no further questions at this time.
Thank you, Ms. Smith.
Thank you.
Mr. Couric.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Jim Couric, and I represent the athlete Continental General Tire. We are asking this court to affirm the decision of the Court of Appeals, which directed a verdict in favor of the company. Alternatively, if this court's decision is to reverse that aspect of the Court of Appeals' decision, then we're asking either this court directly or through remand to the Court of Appeals to address the other issues we raised relating to our request for a new trial based on the various evidentiary errors and jury instruction errors that occurred at the trial court level. Since the Court of Appeals never addressed those issues, finding them moot based on the directed verdict determination.
Did you file cross appeal?
No, we did not.
Did you present assignments of error or propositions of law on behalf of appellee?
I'm sorry, we were the appellant before the Court of Appeals. And we raised those issues before the Court of Appeals because the Court of Appeals did not rule on them as being moot and only ruled on the directed verdict issue.
Yeah, I understand what you said. Did you file a cross appeal in this court?
No, it's our understanding we're not required to on moot issues. If there was a finding of the Court of Appeals that with which we disagreed, then we would be required to file a cross appeal.
I'm interested in that because you're arguing now about Rule 12A. Where have we said, or where can I find, that if the Court of Appeals says an issue is moot, that you, if you want to preserve it, don't have to file a cross appeal here, or under 2505-22, present assignments of error on behalf of an appellee?
I'm not aware of any case law that I can cite to the court. However, since there was no determination by the court on that issue, I don't believe cross appeals necessary. We did preserve those issues by filing them, addressing them as alternative grounds for relief in our brief to this court. And we deal with that, we preserve those issues for either determination by this court or remand to the Court of Appeals for determination, which is, as we understand the case law, in this court's discretion.
Did you argue to the jury the issue that this was not a comparable job?
Yes.
Did you request a jury instruction on it?
We requested, yes, we did. We did. We asked for instructions as to the detail of what would constitute a similarly situated issue. One point I'd like to address relating...
Did you get a jury instruction?
No, we did not. The court did not give that jury instruction. The issue of whether comparability only goes to the pay claim or the other claims, I take issue with what Ms. Smith indicated in that regard. If you look at the claims that were presented, the way they were presented at trial in this case, the claims were entirely based on Ms. Crow's claim that she was not given the same treatment as other comparable male employees, not only with respect to pay, but with respect to various decisions that were made.
Well, education and those sorts of things that she says she was promised, but the question of terminating her employment because her job had been eliminated and then those duties, as she claims, were given, and there was testimony by the persons that assumed her duties that they assumed, it seems to me, of over 50% of the work she was doing. I guess that's a different issue, isn't it? Isn't that doesn't go to comparability of positions.
Her initial claim was that where all of the other, what she termed comparable managers, were allowed to move to Charlotte, North Carolina when the company relocated, she should have been too, because they all should have been. She was carved out and treated differently from them. That's where she raised the issue of her comparability to them. She then attempted to raise the issue of the job that was subsequently created that Mr. Bankston took as somehow demonstrating some pretextual issue as it related to the claims Yeah, her initial claims of discrimination. The problem with this case, as it was presented to the jury, was that everything was looped together. It was all blended together. This was not a case, and if you look at the way the case was presented by the plaintiff, the way the case was argued by the plaintiff, this was not a case of we have a distinct pay claim, we have a distinct promotion claim, we have a distinct termination claim. This was a case where the plaintiff said, we have a whole variety of issues that adversely affected the plaintiff throughout the course of her employment.
Isn't it the duty of the defense attorney to say, wait a second, we have separate issues, we've got to consider them separately, we have a comparable issue claim, we have a wrongful. Isn't that a defense job? Did the defense attorney
do that? Yes, we did attempt to do that. In our preliminary instructions to the court, the proposed jury instructions, we attempted to do that. When the court then was going through the instructions that it intended to give, we again raised the various issues that were not being explained to the jury, the various specific claims that were not being explained, and it was plaintiff's counsel's position that, well, this is not a pay claim, even though pay claims run throughout the case. This is all the claim under 4112.99. Her overall treatment in relationship to these male managers while she was employed at General Tire. That was the position the plaintiff took. That was the argument that the trial court accepted.
Were you prohibited at all from presenting your argument that this was not comparable to other than the claim of the lack of jury instruction, you were like prohibited from presenting an argument?
From presenting the argument, no.
There was evidence on that
point. We were not prohibited. But
so the basis is the jury got your evidence, got your argument.
Without any guidance from the court as to what they should do with it, and coupled with all of the other evidentiary matters the court let in that had nothing whatsoever to do with her case. Yes, the jury ultimately heard pieces of it, but as this court is well aware, a jury requires some guidance from the court. The trial court's obligations include making certain that only relevant evidence is admitted in front of the jury, making sure the jury has appropriate instruction on what they should consider. That did not occur here. When the Court of Appeals looked at the totality of the plaintiff's claims in this case, the court determined that there was not enough to even make out a prima facie case of discrimination. Plaintiff cites to the, I believe it's pronounced Glinner case that this court decided earlier this year. There, this court and even the appellate court acknowledged that the plaintiff had already established a prima facie case, some legitimate non-discriminatory reasons had been presented, and the real debate was the evidence of pretext or lack thereof. And that there was circumstantial evidence, there was statistical evidence, there was even some direct evidence. And this court said, where there's that much evidence on a directed verdict standard, you can't usurp the view of the jury. When there's enough evidence that they could look at, and then that was even a close decision by this court as to whether that would be, you know, the rule in the state, but by a 4-3 majority, that was the decision of those
courts. Not only did this court determine that Glinner, but the U.S. Supreme Court, about the same time in Reeves, said essentially the same thing, precisely what this court said. And I'm looking at page 5 of the Court of Appeals, which of course was rendered before either of those cases, ours or the U.S. Supreme Court. It says, considering the evidence presented by Crowe, reasonable minds could only conclude that she did not demonstrate the downside of being different from similar situations. How do you get that language out of the projects of either the U.S. Supreme Court case or our case?
In the Glinner case, as I said, there was far more evidence and there was already a presumption that a prima facie case had been established. That is not the case here. There is not that kind of evidence, and we're going to the very basics of whether there's enough as a threshold to even have the case proceed in court.
Well, if you take her evidence, why is there not a prima facie case here? I don't want to go through it all. You know what it is, but it sure seems to me that there is. Why is there not a prima facie case?
as it relates to this whole issue of my comparability and how I was treated vis-a-vis the other managers.
Well, I'm told I can't have this position because I don't have a... If you get more education, she gets education. Somebody else who doesn't even have a college degree gets the position. I mean, you can tick off the various
actually,
facts,
that's
but...
not a fact in this case. She never applied for the position that the gentleman held who did not have a college degree. He came into the Treasury Department
right, but
much later and... had been doing it for about 30 years.
She trained him.
She trained him, didn't she?
What she has on this whole comparability issue is her subjective belief, which is legally not sufficient. She has the fact that these different positions, which did very different functions, very clear in there, very different functions, all bore the title manager, which is not legally sufficient. And she had evidence that, let me think a second, she, at different points in time, these different positions would report to the Treasury function, the Treasury. At one point in time, it was these two positions. At another point in time, some other positions were added. And there's record evidence of how and when they came in. And she believed these folks were her peers because they all wore the title of manager. That is the evidence. That is the sum total of the evidence, and as the Court of Appeals found, that is simply legally insufficient to establish a prima facie case. And where that is the case, viewing that evidence and determining it is not legally sufficient, then a directed verdict is correct.
What about the job abolition?
I'm sorry?
The job the abolition of her job and then the parsing out of her duties to other male employees.
I guess... to the extent we're ignoring her claim that she was not treated the same as the other managers in the shift, and now we're focusing on that very particular issue.
Right. It seems to me to be a big part of her case, or at least
actually
a significant
not.
Part of it, maybe not. But if the Court of Appeals didn't think so, they didn't hardly even mention it. I mean, they just, as a matter of law, she loses. And
because the Court of Appeals looked at the totality of the case that she presented, not the case she's now arguing on appeal, but the case she presented to the trial court, the case she presented to the jury. And the case she presented to the jury was, I wasn't treated the same as these comparable managers in all these different respects.
So did she not present to the jury the issue of the abolition of her job?
No, there were facts relating to that. There were a variety of facts, many facts.
Could that be something the jury used to render their judgment for her, do you think, or not?
If they were looking purely at the issue of the abolition of her job, if that were the issue they were presented with, the first question would be, could she show a prima facie case? And there'd be an argument there as to whether she could show a prima facie case in terms of a replacement. Was her position replaced, where a clerical person took a lot of the functions, her manager, who had been in existence for a period of years, took some of the functions, and then later when a new position was created with a lot of export functions, some aspect of her treasury functions were also assigned over there. Is that a replacement that would be sufficient to establish a prima facie case? I don't believe so. Then with the explanation offered, can she go further and show pretext that this whole activity was somehow pretextual? The problem we have here is now the plaintiff is trying to take isolated claims and argue them in isolation and say, let's look at this one, let's look at this one. We're required to look, and we're asking this court to look, at the entire record of the trial in this case. In this case, those claims were not presented in that fashion. They were presented in terms of one overall, from 1987 through the day I left the company, I wasn't treated the same as the male managers. That's the case that she presented. The other problem that we have with this case is all of the evidentiary issues that were allowed to get in front of the jury. For them, in addition to this sort of hodgepodge of comparability that was presented as the plaintiff's case, then we've got issues of a former female employee coming in and saying, I was discriminated against some years ago. Ms. Crow being allowed to testify that some years earlier she had spoken to someone in EEO and that person had made comments.
Let me stop you there. I'm hearing you say, and I... correct me if I'm wrong, that the plaintiff has to show a prima facie case on each of the acts of the employer about which she complains. Is that you're saying she threw them all in together, but why wouldn't you do that if you're trying to show that an employer was discriminating, was biased against you because of your gender? Why wouldn't you throw in as many examples as you could show? Does she have to show that each one of them is standing alone, presents a prima facie case, or can she collectively argue that if you take all of these acts of the employer, that shows a prima facie case of discrimination?
Well, I think the problem, if you're mixing too many different types of claims, like pay, promotion, termination, is that the elements of a prima facie case for each one is different.
Well, it would, sure.
And therefore, you certainly would have to necessarily show all of the elements of each one of those claims, if indeed you intended to pursue it that way. The plaintiff obviously has the ability to determine how she wishes to present her case, be it showing the very distinct issues or showing the totality of the circumstances. Plaintiff here opted to take the approach of showing the totality of the circumstances and constantly the comparison to the male.
How would you well defend it in any case of this nature? Would the employer do precisely the same thing? Show the totality of the circumstances maybe this crude remark or this bad statement or this bad thing happened here, but over here we did three other things that are good. We sent her to college. We
certainly
did actually. We gave her maternity leave. We paid her full boat all the while. We have all these other good things that we did that would show. One item in isolation looks bad, but when you take the whole employment record, isn't that how you defend one of these?
When it's presented the way it was, that's about the only way you can defend it. If it's presented with the specific issues broken out and pursued separately, then there are certain very specific issues you can raise in response to those specific claims. But yes, certainly when one is presenting a claim, one will present whatever countervailing evidence one has available to demonstrate fair and reasonable treatment. I mean, to not do that would be senseless in an employment case. I see the red light is on, and I want to thank the court for its time.
Thank you, Mr. Couric. Ms. Smith, you save 5 minutes of your time.
I'd like to first address the issue raised by Justice Douglas as to whether the appellee's request to remand is back to the appellate court to determine other issues raised on appeal is appropriate, and I do not believe it is. We also have three issues that we raised at the appellate court that were rendered moot by the appellate court's decision, and we raised them before this court, and we believe that if in fact the appellee wanted those issues raised, they should raise them in cross appeal. More importantly, as you look at the evidence in this case, and I think there's voluminous evidence in this case of discrimination, beginning in 1987 and continuing through 1996. And that evidence clearly demonstrates a pattern and practice of sex discrimination, clearly demonstrates disregard by the appellee to correct this discrimination. I think that the argument that Mr. Turek made just a few minutes ago that there isn't sufficient evidence of a prima facie case of discrimination is just ignoring the facts in the record. Mr. Turek made the statement that I am presenting a different case to this court than I presented to the jury. In fact, my statement of facts contains citations to the record that is the case we presented to the jury, and that's the case which Mr. Turek represented we presented to the jury. As I pointed out in my reply brief, if you look at the proposed jury instruction provided by Mr. Turek to the court, and those are specifically at page 374 of the supplement, he states, I have a claim of intentional discrimination, and it includes these things that we believe General Tyre did to discriminate against my client. I do not believe that we had to prove each and every item of discrimination. If Mr. Turek, in fact, wanted a burden of proof on each of those items, then at the trial court, he should have requested that interrogatory be provided to the jury to lay out each element or each issue so that he would have a record on appeal. As it is, the claim went to the jury, as Mr. Curran requested in his proposed jury instruction that it go to the jury. A sex discrimination claim, including lower pay, denial of employment opportunities, and terminating her employment and replacing her with a male employee. With respect to the jury instructions that Judge Murphy provided to the jury, they mimic the instructions that were provided by Mr. Curran, by the appellee, to the trial court. They are a legally correct statement of the law. They are a legally correct statement of Ms. Crowe's burden of proof as to her claim for sex discrimination. With respect to the issue of comparability, once again, Mr. Kirk, I wasn't quite sure what way he was going on comparability. At one point, he made some statements that it appeared that comparability had to be an issue with respect to Ms. Crowe's claim for discriminatory termination and replacement. We do not believe that that is the law. That issue was irrelevant to that claim. Finally, we believe that this case is similar to the Gleiner case. Certainly, after reading the Court of Appeals decision of the Gleiner case, I think we have more facts in Ms. Crowe's favor as to a pattern and practice of discrimination, as to a repeated ignoring of this discrimination by General Tire, that General Tire lied and covered up his actions, and therefore we would respectfully request, Your Honors, that this case be reversed, that the jury's verdict be reinstated, that the issue of punitive damages be remanded for a jury trial, that this court consider awarding attorney's fees and costs as part of the make-whole remedy under Ohio's anti-discrimination statute, and that this court remand with an order to award prejudgment interest in this case. Do you have any further questions? I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Smith. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.